are so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, February the 26th, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by our co-host, Elise Jacobson.
Hi.
And our guest co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Hi there.
Welcome, everyone. We have a fantastic show for you today. First of all, we reported on the show last week of the lawsuit that the Vancouver Aquarium has just filed against local filmmaker Gary Charbonneau for his aquarium documentary expose entitled Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. While the aquarium has previously stated they have problems with the actual content in the film, this lawsuit is only for copyright violations and follows shortly after Gary made the film public for free for viewing on the internet last month. He'll be on the show today to respond to the allegations against him. And for our feature interview, we'll be speaking with an activist who is literally risking his life to save the lives of animals. His name is Mark Ching, and he's the founder of the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation, a not-for-profit located in Sherman Oaks, California. Their mission is to rescue and rehabilitate severely abused and injured animals, and he is taking this mission across the globe as he's made 4 trips now to Asia as of last year, with another one coming up in 3 days next week. And on these trips, he goes to dog slaughterhouses to save dogs there from horrible torture and ultimate death for the meat trade. This is an amazing interview that I recorded earlier this week, and I hope you'll stay to listen to the words and stories of this hero for the animals. So there's a special holiday coming up on March 1st. And what is it, Caroline?
It is National Pig Day, and who doesn't love a pig? I do love pigs. I do.
Yeah, I definitely have a certain affinity for pigs, as can be demonstrated by going onto my Facebook page at any time.
And mine, and mine as well. So I thought we would celebrate the pig by discussing a few pig fun facts and a little bit of history about the pig. And the pig originated from Eurasian wild boars. The largest pig ever recorded in history was a Poland-China hog named Big Bill, and he weighed 2,552 pounds.
Wow.
That's a ton. Was 9 feet long and 5 feet tall. That's a big pig. You would not want that pig to sit on you. And the largest litter of pigs on record is 37. However, the average litter is 12.
Wow, can you imagine fitting 37 babies inside your tummy?
Yeah. That's... I imagine nursing the 37 babies.
Yeah, that's take shifts.
There would probably be more than one runt in that litter. Mm. It may surprise you to know that pigs are more intelligent than dogs. They are ranked fourth next to or behind chimpanzees, dolphins, and elephants. And I looked a little bit further into the cognitive development of pigs, and Professor Bloom of Cambridge says that pigs have the cognitive sophistication of a 3-year-old. So I went and did a little research on what 3-year-olds are capable of cognitively. They can identify colors. They understand same and different. So one of these things is not like the others. Pigs can do that. They can follow 3-part commands. Understand time, what is morning, noon, and night, count and understand counting, complete puzzles, recognize identity in common objects, and pictures. That's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
they're good swimmers. And I don't know if you have seen the video of the pig that went into the water to save the goat, but it's quite dramatic.
I have seen that. And yeah. then there's also the video of the pig swimming in the Bahamas, which I really want to go to that island see them swimming in the Bahamas.
That's my dream vacation. Mark, if you're listening, for my 55th birthday, I think that might be a nice idea. Now, pigs communicate constantly with each other, and they have more than 20 vocalizations that have been identified. And newborn piglets learn to run to their mother's voices and recognize their own names. And mother pigs sing to the young while they're nursing. Professor Stanley Curtis of Penn State University has found that pigs can play joystick-controlled video games and are capable of abstract representation. He believes that there is much more going on in terms of thinking and observing by these pigs than one would have ever guessed. Pigs don't eat like pigs, and they don't pig out. They prefer to eat slowly and savor their food. And they're clean animals. If given space, they'll carefully not soil the area in which they sleep or eat. Pigs live on average about 15 years, or so they should. Mm. Now, Elise, you volunteered with some pigs. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that actually when you were talking about how intelligent they are. I've volunteered a couple times at Pigs Peace Sanctuary, which is in Stanwood, Washington, in the States. And the woman who runs the sanctuary, her name is Judy, and she's been doing it for something like 20 years, this amazing woman. She has this big, beautiful property in Stanwood, lots of green grass and trees, and they have, I think, I can't remember exactly how many pigs live there. It's something like 200, maybe 250 pigs.
I know it's a lot. I'm going to look it up right now.
Oh, okay. and they're just, you know, pigs of all sizes and all different types. And it's just such a wonderful place to go and volunteer and help out or just go and visit. I highly recommend if you ever get a chance to just go and visit, do a little tour. But I remember that Judy one time told us a story about a pig who lives there. His name is escaping me. It was something like Orville or something really cute. But apparently the pigs are so intelligent that if they just observe a person unlatching a gate, they just watch you do it, and they can then figure out how to do it themselves, or they can just go behind you and unlatch the gate. Mm-hmm. So this one particular pig, I guess they had a latch on a certain gate that was a little too easy to open or something, and he got it open and let out a whole bunch of his pals, and there was just mayhem in the sanctuary
pig
for a little bit.
Pals. I want
yeah. They were just running around and
pig mayhem.
having a great time. So it really is. It's pretty incredible, and just when you interact with them, you can tell there's so much going on behind those eyes. They're really sizing you up. And
absolutely. You know, I just remembered that I volunteered once at Hearts on Noses Sanctuary. It's a local sanctuary here in Mission, BC, for many pot-bellied pigs and one or two pink pigs. And I remember we were encouraged to bring treats for the pigs in the form of vegetables, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, the one pig, what was her name? I can't remember that, but the pink pig that Janice has there, she was so inquisitive and totally getting into my handbag to get the treats I had brought. Yeah, absolutely. That was a fun day getting to know all those pigs for sure.
They're really wonderful creatures.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to us about pigs.
Anytime.
Remember, March 1st is National Pig Day. So on that day, let's do something special to honor our fellow pig friends.
Mm-hmm. Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food. Sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food. Hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
Thank you. Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maud Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
So we have some events coming up this weekend. Saturday, February 27th, that's tomorrow, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., the organization Stop UBC Animal Research will be tabling at the annual Pet Lovers Show at the Trade and Exhibition Center in Abbotsford. Their event page says, "This is a perfect venue for us to show that humane toys and treats are the way of the future for truly caring animal lovers, all the while spreading the message of respecting life in all its forms. If you can't commit to a shift at the table, you can still help out. Vegan cookies and nibblies for cats and dogs would be welcome for our donation basket. Please message us." So again, the organization to message is Stop UBC Animal Research if you want to help them out this weekend. Then on Sunday, February 28th, from 12 to 4 p.m., the third annual Rabbit Adoption Day, hosted by Nice Shoes, is happening. Nice Shoes is at 3568 Fraser Street. This event supports the Small Animal Rescue Society of BC in finding forever and foster homes for their rescued rabbits. At this event, adoptable rabbits will take over the center of the store during shopping hours. Anyone interested in adopting, fostering, or simply learning about house rabbits is welcome to come and interact with the bunnies. SARS volunteers at Small Animal Rescue Society, again, will be on hand to answer all of your questions. And if you already have a house rabbit, you're welcome to bring him or her to get a nail trim by donation to SARS or pick out a potential housemate. So please help spread the word about this event to anyone who may be interested in adopting a house rabbit. Again, that's Sunday, this coming Sunday, 12 to 4.
You're not allowed to go, are you, Caroline?
I've been prohibited.
Oh, why?
Because my menagerie is too extensive as it is, and we might never find housing.
Oh, yeah.
In the city. We might actually have to move to a farm and make our own sanctuary.
Okay, well.
Everybody except Caroline.
Come on, you could use an extra bunny to your
family. I could not agree more.
Well, yeah, I think for anybody that's going to be a whole lot of cute, fluffy fun, so worth checking out. And then also on Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m., again, that's this Sunday, February 28th, the organization Surrey Chicken Save is holding their bi-monthly vigil at Sunrise Poultry Processing Plant, which is located at King George Boulevard and 73A Avenue in Surrey. This is the largest poultry processing plant in Western Canada, with approximately 100,000 birds killed daily at just 32 days old each, excuse me. Yeah, so awful. So Surrey Chicken Save says they're a peaceful group who don't engage in verbal or physical confrontations. Everyone is welcome to join them in holding signs or handing out leaflets to passersby. So again, that's 1 to 3 p.m. this coming Sunday, February 28th. Get in touch with Surrey Chicken Save for more information. Ah, so a lot going on all in one weekend.
And if you have any animal-related news or events, I should say, that you want to have aired on Animal Voices, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post a note on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. So you are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. Our first interview today is with local filmmaker Gary Charbonneau. He's the director of the feature-length documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, which is an exposé against the Vancouver Aquarium and the cruelty and corruption behind its doors. It was recently published for free viewing on both Vimeo and YouTube last month. And now, as of last week, the Vancouver Aquarium Aquarium is suing Gary for copyright violation in the making of the film. Gary is here today to respond to the allegations and the impact of the lawsuit on the film thus far. Hello, Gary, and welcome back to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to tell us about this lawsuit and your side of the story. This lawsuit against you is specifically for copyright infringement. Can you explain what these allegations are, please?
Well, we're still trying to understand them, to be quite honest. It's relatively new, so I can't delve into it too much. I was only served last week, but yes, they're claiming there's copyright infringement and breach of contract, but... At the end of the day, really, every Canadian has the right to research, bring forward information, and educate the public. And so this is really trying to stifle democracy and freedom of speech. And I think this is why there's a lot of people who not only have concerns about this lawsuit from the aquarium, but are not very happy with it.
Hi, Gary. Elise here. So as a result of the injunction, I understand that Vimeo already took the video off their website, but it's still on YouTube and also on your site, VancouverAquariumUncovered.com. So first of all, what have the views been like on YouTube since this story broke out in the media last week? And I'm also wondering, what will it take to have the film removed from YouTube?
Well, we're not too sure about YouTube, but to answer the second question first, we'd have to look at as far as what their policies are. We were in touch with Vimeo, and Vimeo would like to put the video back up because we did claim that there were no copyright infringements, but their policies state that if a claim has started, that they automatically have to keep it off until it's been clarified and gone through the courts and or resolved anyways. And so, what was the other question?
How many views have you had on YouTube, or has there been a change in the amount of views since the story broke out in the media last week?
My apologies.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, well, because of the Vancouver Aquarium making this claim, they've actually almost doubled in a week. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's brought a lot of attention in the news, in the media. And so there's a lot more people are looking at this film, which is good because it's factual, it's truthful, and this is why apparently right now they're not suing me for any slander or defamation, and yet they've accused me of misleading and deceiving, but I've done no such thing. So that's what. So they reverted to a copyright infringement claim.
Mm-hmm. Gary, I'm wondering, they call this video in the notice of claim, which I read, the offending video in quotes. And so I'm wondering, with regards to this offending video, do you have any thoughts as to the timing of the lawsuit? This film came out a while ago, came out last year, last summer, if I recall correctly. It was only just put on YouTube and on Vimeo for free viewing for the whole world to see as of last month. Any thoughts on the timing as to the timing of the lawsuit, which has served pretty much right after the free release of this film online?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and what we did last year, we only had a few screenings, so it wasn't released to the public until just January. But they did know about the film, and so that's a very good point that they never said anything or contacted me. And so it was only after it was released in January, and they contacted Vimeo before they contacted me. So there's a lot of questions about the genuine nature of their claim against me. But I would also like to mention that during this time that they have made this lawsuit or brought it forward, is that they've made a statement that they encourage open discussion. This is absolutely untrue, because one of my screenings at a university, we did invite them to join the panel. They refused. I have been on various radio shows. At least two of them have invited the Vancouver Aquarium to participate. They neglected to join in that public discussion. And on January 21st, of this year, just recently, I sent an email to the Vancouver Aquarium inviting them to a public panel discussion to discuss the issues at the aquarium that are contained within my film, and they have never replied. So when they make these statements to the public, they're misleading everyone because they're not encouraging open discussion. They have been invited numerous times to talk about the film, but they just want to hide behind closed doors. making empty statements.
Well, that's interesting to hear, because from what I'm hearing is it's they're not participating in communication with you. Were there any attempts on their part since the film came out to communicate to you perhaps their thoughts on their views on this film? I know that they've posted a post on their blog saying that they have problems with your film, the content of it, but was there any ever before this notice of claim last week, any communication with you, Gary, as a person saying, hey, we're not okay with this film and these are the reasons why?
Well, they never contacted the company, Evotion, or myself to discuss any issues, and that's problematic because you know, they should have tried to at least reached out and said that and discussed this with me, but they never did.
So they have said on their blog post that this film is not a documentary, in quotes, not grounded in the truth, and they've denied the claims made in the film. In that case, why aren't they suing you for defamation instead of copyright, which would seem to be a larger and more serious issue to deal with? I guess you don't necessarily know the definitive answer about this, but what would be your thoughts on that?
Because they can't sue me for defamation. The information in the film, such as, you know, a 90% infant death rate, fund allocation issues, the dolphins that have been in Japan for 10 years, 9 years, these are all true. And so this is why we believe that they didn't bring anything forward, because they would definitely have a difficult time because it's factual. And I've also I urge people to contact the aquarium about the information in the film and to do their own research. And some people have, and they've contacted me back and said, "Yeah, you're right. This is, you know, they did not allocate any monies from the $100 million that they acquired to the rescue center, and the fund allocation towards research, conservation, and education has been diminished, as admitted by the aquarium in my film during an interview." So the facts are truthful. So this is why I think that they've reverted to a copyright claim.
Yeah, I did see the film myself, and I have to say it was incredibly well researched. So I'm just wondering, like, what are your thoughts about when they say, I mean, you went to all this trouble, all this effort to research this film that you put together. Why would they say it's not grounded in the truth? Like, what grounds would they have for that? Like, it seems to be such a flippant thing to say with regards to all the information that's in the documentary itself.
Well, the film highlights some major issues, huge concerns with this so-called Marine Science Center. And as I pointed out in the film, that they're definitely trying to build an entertainment park, and they're no longer really focused and are certainly not allocating the proper funds towards what we would believe to be a research, conservation, and education center. And it also shows that with how they're treating the Marine Mammal Rescue Center. So they have to try to appease the public by misleading them once again by saying it's not grounded in truth, but we continue to ask, you know, what parts of the film are not grounded in truth, and there's no response. So we would love to have a discussion. I'm inviting the aquarium once again to have an open discussion, as they say in their statement. So I'm waiting to hear back from them, but I don't think I will.
Hi, Gary. This is Caroline here, and I have a quick question for you. On reading the notice of claim, the aquarium is seeking punitive damages, saying that you are guilty of, and this is a long list, reprehensible, insulting, high-handed, spiteful, malicious, and oppressive conduct, and such conduct by the defendants justifies the court in imposing a substantial penalty of exemplary damages on the defendants, imposing an award of aggravated damages. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's definitely very animated. Mm-hmm. It's like a fictional novel.
Yeah.
It's very exaggerated, to say the least. And so I think that, like I said, this fire has been started, and they're trying to put it out. But the Vancouver public, you can say probably maybe 20 years ago, the public was on the side of the aquarium because of all the indoctrination and advertising that the aquarium was doing. But over the past, I would say even 10 years, with the movie Blackfish and all the information and the people here in Vancouver educating the public about what's really happening at this aquarium, I think that the residents are now starting to see what the Vancouver Aquarium is truthfully doing. And now I would say they're actually not just sitting on the fence. I think they've got one foot on the other side, and I think that they're panicking right now. There's a lot of pressure on them, and the truth is coming out.
So if you're not spiteful, Gary, as you say you're not, what are you? What is your main motivation here?
It's a sad situation. I don't like the deception. The 90% infant death rate is completely unacceptable. It's beyond me how they can continue to call themselves a conservation center, saying that they're going to help these belugas in the wild. But the evidence shows that they're not helping them in the wild, and that they're dying at fantastically higher death rates in aquaria. They have, just for the belugas alone, 4 out of 5 have died. That's an 80% death rate. In the wild, in normal circumstances, is 20% as high as 30%. So how is it that they say that they're going to look after the belugas in the wild when they can't even look after them in their own tanks? And then you have the issues of short lifespan, and then the fund allocation issues, the dolphin rescue and rehabilitation that's non-existent. They're just really going to Japan and just buying dolphins that do tricks. When you look at Spinnaker was sitting at Osaka Ring Aquarium for 10 years before the Vancouver Aquarium obtained him. That's not a rescue. That's not rehabilitation. But they label that to deceive the public. And then what they do is people spend money, and the Vancouver Aquarium makes a lot of profits, and people are paid high salaries, and they continue to mislead people under the guise of conservation and rescue. And it's just simply not there.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Gary, to speak on the lawsuit that the Vancouver Aquarium has filed against you regarding your film, Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. You can watch the film for free still on YouTube, as well as at VancouverAquariumUncovered.com. Thank you, Gary. Good luck with this and have a good day.
Thank you so much for your time.
And we have some news.
Yeah, now for the news. The UK Parliament has announced they are going to end the tradition of writing laws on calfskin. The House of Lords recently announced that by April, the United Kingdom Parliament will no longer follow the 1,000-year-old tradition of writing new laws on dried calfskin. Instead of using calf vellum, the Parliament will switch to archival paper, which has a 500-year lifespan. Removing dried calfskins will save approximately £80,000, or about $116,000 per year, the Parliament said. Historical documents such as the Magna Carta are printed on animal vellum, and opponents of this decision have expressed concern about the disappearance of historical documents printed on archival paper, even though digital storage of documents is currently an option, obviously. A spokesman for the House of Lords stated, "We took the view a long time ago that we wanted this to stop, and as far as we are concerned, the decision has been made. This decision will save 130 baby cows for every 500 pieces of paper." So that's some good news.
Wow, that's excellent news. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to discuss this rash of barn fires that's been happening across Canada, and with no less than 10 of them being in Ontario in 2016 alone. And it represents a catastrophic loss of life and a painful loss of life to these animals, which are asphyxiated and burned to death. And I feel compelled just to honor these animals by just detailing very quickly each one of these barn fires in terms of the animals that died and in the number that they died in. And so I'll do that quickly. On January the 4th, 43 standard bred horses died. Now, all of these fires are in Ontario. January 12th, a barn fire kills all the chickens inside the barn. Now, there are thousands and thousands of chickens in each one of those chicken barns. January 14th, 12 horses die in a barn fire. January 17th, 500 milking goats and 30 cattle die in a barn fire near Delaware. 2,100 pigs die January 19th in a massive barn fire west of Park Hill, Ontario. January 23rd, 200 pigs killed in a barn fire near Stratford. That's my hometown. February 1st, more than 80 dairy cows die in a barn fire outside of London, Ontario. 1,000 pigs die February 19th in a barn fire in Hensel, February 14th. 70 cows are dead, actually 50 cows and 20 calves in Brockton, Ontario, February 25th. 300 pigs dead in a barn fire near Atwood.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, I got really emotional when I was reading each one of these articles, I have to say. It's really powerful, too, when you start thinking about the loss of life and how much suffering occurred in each one of these fires. Now, this barn fire epidemic really highlights the virtual absence of any fire safety measures taken to prevent the animals from burning alive. The barns aren't even equipped with alarms or sprinklers. So a very important petition has taken off by the Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Farmed Animals, demanding that the industry create a barn fire code of practice, and they have 33,000 signatures already. The petition recommends common sense structure requirements like alarm sprinklers, fire compartmentalizing, maintaining electrical wiring, and protocols for responding to fire. Anna Pippas with Animal Justice says the fire marshal must investigate the cause of these blazes along with the SPCA, which enforces animal protection laws in the province, if the fire and consequent animal suffering were caused by negligence, cruelty charges must be considered. Animal Justice is calling for investigations into each one of these fires. And now what makes these, you know, fires so hard to put out is, of course, the hay, the straw, and many of the barns have chemicals stored in them as well. So when they go up, they really go up. And quite often when the fire rescue arrives, there's no rescuing to be done. They just try to contain the fire and the animals burn to their death.
You know, I'd really like to see us cover this in further detail on a future show. Mm-hmm. So let's do that. Can we commit to doing that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
We're talking about it a lot earlier today, and it's just not something that the mainstream media, I think, is appropriately covering. So mm-hmm. look out for an interview about this story in the near future on Animal Voices. Thank you for that, Caroline. And
you're welcome.
Elise. So you are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5. FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
For our feature interview, we have animal activist Mark Ching on the show. He is the founder of the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization in California focused on rescuing and rehabilitating severely abused animals. And as one of his life's missions, he travels to countries in Asia to save dogs there from the meat industry, and he has witnessed terrible things and risked his life in doing so. Today, just days before he embarks upon another trip to Asia, he is here to speak to us about his rescues and the dog meat industry. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to speak about your work in rescuing dogs in Asia. I am so interested to know about this. First of all, we're just so disconnected here in North America about the dog meat industry. And I wonder if you could please start by telling us about the trade for dog meat in Asia and explain for our listeners some facts about the slaughter and consumption of dogs in these countries.
Well, so in Asia, they eat dogs, unlike here where, you know, they're more domesticated and they're pets. And so I go to different countries because, you know, this practice where they eat them for usually traditional reasons. My foundation, we kind of focus on torture and abuse. And so in these countries, I go because they have this, I guess it's a cultural thing where they feel if they abuse the animal first, the adrenaline released, or the animal going through some type of torture, it makes whoever eats the meat stronger or the meat tastes better. And so that's what I'm doing out there. I'm rescuing those type of dogs, but I'm trying to highlight this kind of practice that takes place where, in my eyes, it's something that's inhumane.
Right. And from your perspective, what is the attitude towards dogs and relationships with dogs in places like China and South Korea? From what I understand, people do have dogs as quote unquote pets there, but they're seen as status symbols. Is that true, or can you elaborate on that more?
Well, each country I've been to, they have a different type of attitude towards dogs.
Okay.
You know, in China and Korea, it's totally different from like how they are in Vietnam. But in China and Korea, dogs are becoming more a part of society. And so if you look at things, the younger generation doesn't really eat dogs or things anymore. It's usually the older generation. So now you have to go out of the cities to find this practice that's kind of occurring. But the attitude towards dogs is people actually like them, or they welcome into their family. However, there's a part of that society that eats dogs and looks at it a different way. And so, I guess there's both.
Right. So as far as I know, you've been to Asia now 4 times to rescue dogs. And from what I read on your website, you said, I guess this was the first time you said you left America without a plan, without knowing anyone in China, without anything but a bag and a ticket. I think that's incredible. Can you tell us about this, please? How did this all transpire for you to decide to go to China to rescue dogs? What led up to this?
Well, it started last year. September was my first trip. But before then, there was all that highlight on that festival, Yulin. Mm-hmm. And so before I started learning about Yulin, I knew people ate dogs, but I didn't know that there was this torture aspect kind of connected to it. And so when I saw that, I had told my wife that I want to go to China to see if these things are true. And so she put up like this huge opposition towards it for such a long time. That I couldn't go. And then one day I sent her this video of them doing something horrific in China. And after she's seen it, she had told me, like, look, if you have to go because that's who you are, then just go. And so literally 3 days later, I was on a plane and I had a backpack and a ticket. I didn't have a place to stay. And I don't even speak Chinese. I only speak American. And that's kind of how it started.
Well, what happened when you went there for the first time? Now, I understand your strategy is that you've posed as a wealthy American dog meat buyer. Is that correct?
That's correct. My strategy's changed. So when I first went there, I didn't even know what I was doing. And so it wasn't until my second trip that I really started going to slaughterhouses. And then I really got into, okay, how can I get better at what I do so I can rescue dogs? I didn't want to have to pay. I didn't want to have to pay for dogs because I kind of felt like I'm pushing, I'm feeding the system. And so now I developed a whole strategy where I go undercover as a dog meat buyer for the American industry and it works well. And so when I leave, kind of like if I'm selling your hotel sandwiches and I'm trying to do a deal, I'll let you try the sandwiches. And so it's the same concept. Like when I leave, I can take so many dogs with me to kind of like kill the dog myself and try the meat. You see? And so that's kind of what I do.
Oh, I see. Okay. So I know you've seen some really terrible things in the slaughterhouses in China. It's hard for me to even believe first that there exist dog slaughterhouses. And I'm sure it's really difficult for our listeners to imagine this as well. It seems unimaginable as well that they would torture these animals beforehand. You explained about why that is. But to help us understand better, I wonder if you can describe for us some of the things you have witnessed in these places and what have you seen being done to the dogs?
I think coming from our society or for someone like me who's never seen, I've never seen something like, I've seen a fish get killed or something, but I've never seen a living creature. And I guess that's a living creature too, but I've never seen an animal like that being killed. And so, China and Korea and North Vietnam, they I don't know if they have no compassion or something, but the way they kill the animals or they slaughter and torture these dogs, it's the most cruel things that a person could see. And so, in China, I've watched them, they bind the feet and they cut the feet off while the dogs are still alive. And then they chain these dogs to tables and they'll just cut their chests open and they torture them. They'll cut their legs off. And it's not like they're just cutting the leg off, but it's like they chop it with like a cleaver and the dogs scream. And, in Korea, which is probably the most brutal thing I've seen, they have a place where they'll get a dog and they'll nail gun the dog into the wall with like a nail gun, and the dogs will hang there and they'll beat them up. And I guess it's supposed to like, they believe like as they're doing it, the dog, they defecate and they throw up everywhere. And so they think it's like purging the meat, but really the dog's in shock because it's just, so brutal. My last trip, I went to North Vietnam and I watched a 6-year-old kid burn a dog alive with a blowtorch. And I couldn't understand, like, how that's even possible for somebody so young to grow up in this environment and have no emotion doing what they're doing. But, you know, I've rescued dogs that they've taken the eyes out of the face with, like, pliers and cut the face off and hit a dog with a chainsaw to cut him in half, and I saved them, and they're still alive. And so that, you know, but it just shows you the type of things that you're doing, you know, and so it's awful.
I just wonder how those actions are perpetuated. It just seems like it's a normal thing for them to be doing there, but even maybe more so than the way we slaughter animals for food here. I mean, I guess, as you said before, I think I heard somewhere that there's a competition for who can produce the best tasting meat, right? And that has to do, they believe, with the adrenaline being released. But it just seems so horrible and evil. I don't know. Like, I can't imagine. And I can't imagine what it must have been like for you to see something like that. I guess there is a good part about it is that you have rescued dogs. So in the trips that you've been there, what happens after you rescue them? And I understand that many actually die shortly after being rescued. Is that correct, due to the severity of their injuries?
So, correct. So in my trip, so I took 4 trips, and in total, I've rescued 249 dogs. That's actual dogs I've brought them out of the slaughterhouse, put into vans, driven them to vets. So 249, and out of those, there's only 61 survivors. Wow. And so, you know, that's less than a third. But it shows to you, like, just the severity of the issues. I only rescue dogs that are being tortured. And I know that sounds kind of weird, but when I go into a slaughterhouse, they might have 75 dogs, you know, and I'm pretty much self-funded, and it's just me. And so I can only do what I can do. So if they cut a dog's legs off and the dog is still alive, then I'll rescue that dog. If they're hanging a dog and they're beating him up, I'll cut him down and I'll rescue that dog. And so that's kind of what I do. And so the amount of dogs who survive, it's low. And if you look at some of the dogs, the ones being hung and beaten with sticks or pipes, or you know, they're not as messed up as, like, a dog with no legs or a dog with 2 legs, or you know, they'll cut their feet off. And so I have dogs that have no feet. But the whole thing is about taking a dog who will die without me, who's being tortured at that moment and who has no hope. And even if they die someplace else, I mean, that's all I want for them, you know, and I would imagine if that was me, or if I was trapped there and they were beating me up and cut my feet off, and I was going to die anyways, but somebody could take me. You know, if they could take me to a place where I'm just, you know, I die in peace or something. Sorry.
It's okay.
And so, you know, but my goal has kind of changed to where in the beginning I did it because I felt I had to. And now, because I've seen so much, I mean, the things I've seen, you just can't even imagine. And so my goal has changed more to document things and create, like, a media campaign. And so this trip that I'm doing now, I'm heading out there on the 2nd. So next week, Monday, I get on a plane at 12:30 at night, and it's to document these things that they're doing, so I can take it to the government and show them, this is why you have to have a cruelty law against animal abuse, or this is why you should make it illegal. And it won't stop it, but that's just a step in the right direction. And you know, for a country like China, they only care about what the world sees. They don't care about anything else but their image. And so if I can tell them, look, you can be the leader of the Asian countries, and you can pass this anti-cruelty law and look like you guys are heroes, you know. But like I said, I know in the gist of things, it won't do much, but it'll still do something. And so that's kind of like what I'm doing now with my journey out there. So it's more political, and I'm trying to document, but I'm still going to rescue, you know, as much as I can.
So of these 61 animals who have made it, I understand that many of them have made it back to America. Can you tell us what's happened with them? I must imagine that they need to be rehabilitated first.
So the process is this. So when I rescue at a slaughterhouse, you know, I'm in there and I get my dogs and my vans pull up and we load the vans up and we go straight to a vet. As a vet, you know, the amount of time they spend out of the America, it's determined on what it takes for them to heal. So like a dog that has no legs, I mean, I have dogs that I've saved from my first trip in September that are still at the vet because, you know, I had a dog that was skinned, you know, half of his body was skinned. And so these cases, you know, the time where it takes for your body to heal or something, I mean, you know, there's no timetable. But from that point, when they are, quote unquote, what the government calls healthy, I can put them up for inspection and I can fly them to America if they pass. And so they come into LAX and then I take them to my foundation, which is in Sherman Oaks, and we adopt them out. Some of the dogs who come in from here, they're under so much trauma that I have a whole rehab set up that's just my own because we do torture and abuse local. And so some of the dogs go there and they'll stay there as long as it takes for them to be okay with people. And that's usually what it is. These dogs are so terrified of another human being that it takes, you know, some of them take months, you know, some of them it's days. They see something new, they sleep on a bed, they have a toy, they have parents, and that's all they need. Where another dog might take 3 months of rehab, you know, and so it's kind of determined on who the dog is, like internally.
And I understand, too, that you have a partnership with an orphanage to create the first dog sanctuary in Beijing. Can you tell us about that and what your hope is for this sanctuary and for reaching out to the people in China there?
Well, the orphanage thing isn't going as well as I thought. And it's not going as well, not because the orphanage or us. It's not going as well because of the government. You know, first of all, the government is against these type of orphanages because it kind of puts a bad light on China. Like, you know, there's these babies that people are dumping in the street because you had this law where they can only have one child. I know they changed that, so I think you can have two now. But that it's a government that makes things so difficult. Currently, I've kind of like segued and done a dual project where in Tibet, there's this Buddhist monk that my team out there knows. And so we're helping to build an actual sanctuary in Tibet that can house 150 to 300 dogs. That's kind of a project we're working on now. The orphanage, we're still trying to work on. They have a farm that these kids work at. And so the idea was that for every dog they took and they helped me to rehab and we would try to adopt them out locally because there's a lot of foreigners there or a lot of people who love animals too. But I would pay or donate to the orphanage to help run it, you see. And it's, you know, it's cheaper than if I had to rehab a dog in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, but it hasn't fully got up and running yet, but it should soon.
Well, I'm not aware of anyone else in North America who is going to Asia to rescue dogs from the meat industry. So why you? What drives you to do this?
You know, I guess it has to do with like our foundation's kind of goal. You know, our whole goal, if you look at the local cases we do, we only do torture, abuse, and cruelty. And that's kind of what we center around. And so that's what I'm good at. I'm good at going into South Central LA to rescue a dog from a gang. And so in China or Asia, you know, whether it's Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, that's my strong point to kind of like, I don't know, face a grim situation and come out alive, I guess. But it's not only that. People don't see how beautiful it is, like what I do. And so as dark as, you know, it's dark. So if you read what I write, it's tragic and it's dark and it's very sad. But there's still beauty in it. I get to go to these places to where there's no hope for these dogs. And I get to be a hero and I get to liberate them and I get to save them. You know, there's this moment in rescue when I'm out there. And at the end of my... In each slaughterhouse, there's at the end where I do my rescue. Whether I'm cutting a dog down from a noose or I'm picking a dog up that they cut two of the legs off, you know, these dogs are so afraid and they're in shock and, you know, they know they're going to die. But there's this moment where I feel that they understand who I am and what I'm doing. And it's just, it is the most moving moment ever. And it's just, you know, people ask why I keep going back because, you know, I have a family, I have children, I have a business. And, you know, if I die, that ends. And it's not that I'm addicted, but I guess I am. You know, it's that moment where it's just, it's beautiful. And, you know, I'm trying to document on this trip coming up when I leave the slaughterhouse. So when I leave the slaughterhouse, I have these vans pull up and they pull up and it's me passing dogs to my group and they have no legs and there's just blood flying everywhere. But it really is a powerful kind of image or a powerful moment. And it's of hope and it's liberation and it's freedom. And it kind of shows that wherever you are, even in darkness, I mean, light can find you if you still believe. And so that's what I do.
Wow. And you've mentioned too that it's that you could die and you don't say that lightly. You've risked your life by doing these rescues. And you've said that in your four trips to Asia, you almost died three times. Can you tell us about that?
Well, so my first trip, because I couldn't speak Chinese, I went to a slaughterhouse in Guangzhou and my translator that I had hired, he was too afraid to accompany me. So I just went anyways, like an idiot. And so I think they didn't understand what I was doing. And so when I entered the slaughterhouse, they literally took me hostage, beat me up. You know, one of the guys tried to cut me with a machete and the other people were trying to like block him. Like, I'm sure they don't want to kill an American or whatever they thought I was. And so that was one time. In Korea, I didn't realize this at the time, but my second trip, they're so afraid of the media. They're so afraid of you taking videos. So I went with a GoPro strapped on me and they beat me up and the guy cut it off of me with a cleaver and like my translator literally like saved my life. But this last trip, I went into a slaughterhouse where they kill about 100 to 500 dogs a day. So it's a very large operation. And it was here. I've never became violent in any of my trips, but I went into processing and there was this dog chained to a table and they were doing something to this dog that I had never seen before. And it's not even in the part where you torture the animal. It's just processing where they'll cut their legs off alive. And that, trust me, that's still torture. But they were doing something and I was trying to get my translator to stop them and he wouldn't. And I kind of became aggressive. And so, you know, they beat me up, wrestled me to the ground, and one of the guys had a gun. And he put it against my temple, and the owner of the slaughterhouse pushed him, but he shot. And he shot like 2 inches from my head. I mean, the guy tried to kill me. And so, you know, they beat me up, took my phone that had tons of my videos that I that I risked my life to obtain. And so... and threw me out of the slaughterhouse. And that's really the closest I've come to dying, you know? And so, yeah. It's
you really are risking your life, Mark. You need to be more careful because this is really important work. You're the only person doing it. And yeah, I don't know what to say. Like, I don't know how you can do that more safely, but you almost died three times and, you know, I don't want to see that happen to you. You're doing such amazing work there. What can our listeners do to support the work of the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation?
People ask me all the time, like, what I need. A lot of people think, like, I need money or something, which I don't. You know, money is not something that we're looking for. If somebody gave me $1 million and I could take that $1 million and give a dollar to each person that would share my post when I'm out there, it's the awareness that I'm looking for, to take what we represent and what we're doing and make it national. You know, I don't understand how, I just don't get it, like how the news in America hasn't picked it up yet, you see, and hasn't tried to mobilize like a national effort to kind of end things or to kind of put pressure on these countries, because that's all you need. All you need is pressure to kind of be like, look, you know, we see what you're doing and be a better country. You know, I wrote a post when I was in China once on how I was in China and Korea, on how in America, culturally and historically, we weren't the best. We had slavery, lynchings, things like that. But in time, our society grew and we learned that those things are not, you know, they're not the right things to do. And in these countries, it's kind of like what I'm trying to teach them, that even though this is history and cultural, sometimes you learn that our culture is better now. And so a lot of people don't know that association in Korea of how bad the torture is or how bad the abuse is of these animals. And I think if they did, things would change. But you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think if it did, if they knew, things would change.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about mobilizing a huge national PR strategy against China as a leader in the world, for example, and pressuring them, I think that's really the way to go. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Mark, to speak about your incredible work in rescuing dogs from the meat industry in Asia. To find out more and to support the work that Mark does, please, as he said, go to his Facebook page, and you can also visit animalhopeandwellness.org and also find them on Facebook. Thank you so much, Mark, and please be careful when you go next week.
I will. Thank you for having me.
What a compelling interview. Thank you, Allison. You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us on our next show next Friday, March 4th. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Our website, animalvoices.org, is where you can stream shows or download shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe to us via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We are an all-volunteer-run radio station and show, and we need your help. If you are interested in producing or hosting shows, doing interviews, if you have web design skills, good organizational skills, and you're familiar with the issues of animal advocacy and veganism, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We can use your help and training will be provided. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're closing the show now with a song dedicated to Mark's rescue work. It's called Silent Cries, Stop Animal Cruelty by Danny Darko, featuring Lulu Felimara. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Nowadays, all I see is blood. Recurring baddies, another deep cut. Victims made of innocence, teardrops of our fellow friends. When will the strong uplift the weak again? How many more have to die? We can make a change, let's unite and save a life. What in the world has gone wrong? It's tearing us to pieces. Is this what we stand for? Speak for the silent, fight for the wounded. No longer hiding. Can't you hear the silent cries? Scream at the violence, no more denying. Thousands are dying. Can't you hear the silent cries? They go unheard, but I can feel how bad they hurt. How many more have to die? We can be the change, let's unite and save a life. What in the world is going wrong? It's tearing us to pieces. Is this what we stand for? Speak for the silence. fight for the wounded. No longer acting, can't you hear the silent cries? Scream at the violence, no more denying.